You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Magic tricks have been used by the practitioners of various religions and cults from ancient times onward to frighten people into obedience or turn them into adherents. However, the profession of the illusionist first became a popular form of entertainment around the 18th century, and it continues to fascinate audiences because what magicians do seems to defy logic and makes the seemingly impossible possible. A new documentary called Deceptive Practices, The Mysteries and Mentors of Ricky Jay, offers a rare glimpse into this enigmatic world through the eyes of the world-renowned stage magician, actor, and writer. It opened yesterday at the Film Forum, and I'm very pleased it has brought Ricky Jay back to our show. Hello.
Hi, and thanks for having me back on your show.
So how did this film come about? Did the filmmakers, Molly Bernstein and Alan Edelstein, approach you?
They approached me a very long time ago about making this film. They approached me something like 15 years ago.
Well, the publicity says this film was at least a decade in the making.
Yeah, it was. It took me a few years to agree, I think. And then it took them a decade or so more to do the film. And
what took so long?
Well, It's a legitimate and good question. I'm not sure I know the answer. But I suppose I was not eager to get into the relationship of someone digging deeply into my life initially. And
you do draw a line on personal matters.
Yeah, I've kind of, you're right, had a long-standing policy about not talking about my family. Although in this case, my grandfather, who got me into magic, is a central character, and it's one of the things I really liked about Molly and Alan in doing this film is they actually found things of my grandfather's that I didn't know about. One of the odd things is my grandfather was, for a while, the cryptography editor of G-Man magazine. And they actually found issues with his column in it. And you know, this was one of the really wonderful things about working with him. They would often uncover the most interesting archival material.
And then there's footage from your childhood. Oh, you must have supplied them with that.
I think my sister had that. Yeah, I hadn't seen that in many, many years. It's thoroughly and completely embarrassing.
No, it's wonderful stuff. Were you ever worried that recording what you do on camera would reveal any of your secrets? Because I know if I have a DVD, I can slow things down and really watch your hands.
Yeah, apparently there are stories about various technicians on television shows and films that I've done doing exactly that, looking at pieces frame by frame. And I have to say, so far at least, I seem to be in pretty good shape.
And in the film, you invite an audience member to get close to your hands as you turn red queens into black twos and then back again. Her nose is maybe 5 inches from the cards, and yet it's clear she hasn't a clue as how you're doing it.
Well, I carefully picked someone who couldn't see anything. it was nice. I think when you get the tale of the woman reporter from The Guardian in London, you realize that the best way to see this is one-on-one in an extraordinarily intimate situation. There's nothing that tops that. As much as I love being on a live stage with a live audience in a small theater, the true experience of being taken by magic is something that should be spontaneous and one-on-one.
Well, you say that a lot of it involves misdirection. Does that differ when you're doing one-on-one as opposed to in front of an audience?
Well, it certainly differs as opposed to in front of a camera, which doesn't much take to misdirection. So, by the way, I should say that misdirection for me is not the idea of looking somewhere else, but the idea of a magician directing your attention to something specific.
Mm-hmm. And which is not the thing that he wants you to really see.
Exactly. If you're doing something surreptitious, it would be to direct you away from some surreptitious activity.
Steve Martin refers to you as a raconteur. So what role does storytelling play in these performances? Is that part of the misdirection?
Well, I don't know if it's part of the misdirection, but it's certainly part of the entertainment. And doing the theater shows, it's an enormous part of it. So I speak about things that I really enjoy, and sometimes the inspirations are literary, and I've done pieces based on films that I've seen and anything that's influenced me, and I try to create stories. As you probably know, I don't like to use the word magic tricks very much. I call them pieces, and that's because there is some theatrical element to them.
And you obviously are interested in the history of what you do. Do you think most magicians, or whatever you want to call them, conjurers, have a sense of the long tradition they come out of?
Well, I think more and more that's starting to happen, which is, to me, a good thing. But I don't know how many of them are interested in, on the level that I am. I mean, fortunately for me, there are a number of them and people that I can talk to. And I think it's an important thing in terms of your craft to know what preceded it.
But when you read about somebody who did some trick in the 18th century, the 19th century, can you kind of figure out what they did and revive it?
Usually you can understand it if you understand the principles of the art, yeah. And initially I think I got into magic, into the history of magic, because the magic shop syndrome, I guess we can call it, there are these stores which sell tricks, mm-hmm. and illusions, and they're built by people and manufactured and sold, and the idea of the shop owner is inevitably to sell the latest piece to everybody who walks in the store. And it didn't take me long as a kid to realize if I wanted to do something different, it might be better to look backwards rather than forwards.
How old were you when you first became interested in even doing this?
Well, I started incredibly young because of my grandfather, so I guess I did my first show at 4 and my first television show at 7, but as I say in the film, I was awful. There's no reason to assume I was some Mozartian-like prodigy. I was an idiot doing mechanical magic effects.
And a lot of other people started that way. Johnny Carson, for example, but
absolutely.
He moved on. You decided that you would stick with it and get better?
I guess. I don't know how conscious it was. I mean, my grandfather tried to teach all the grandchildren, and they all did it for a year or two and lost interest, and I continued on, absolutely.
Yeah. How had your grandfather gotten to know so many of the great magicians of his time?
Well, he was an interesting man, my grandfather. He came over as a boy from Austria-Hungary with no money, and even here had no college education, but managed to really succeed in business. And he had a Wall Street firm. He was a CPA without examination, without a college degree, through an act of Congress, which was quite amazing. And what gave him pleasure was to find hobbies and pick the best people in the world to teach him. So he learned billiards from Willie Hoppe, and he eventually found the wonderful magicians who first were his paid instructors and later became his friends.
Al Flasso performed the ceremony of breaking the magic wand at your grandfather's funeral. What's the meaning behind that ceremony?
Well, I guess this is a tough thing to talk about. I mean, it was such a... I never went to another funeral memorial service for 30 years after that. The idea of standing up and showing the passing of life by breaking a magic wand, it was tough to witness.
Now, you learned from some pretty great magicians. Would it be possible to have gotten to the place you got to if you hadn't known people like Cardini, Slidini, Francis Carlyle, Roy Benson?
It's a good question. I guess I would have to say yes, because there have been people who've lived in isolated areas. There's a fellow who died recently named Jerry Andrus, who lived in Albany, Oregon, mm-hmm. who created really wonderful original effects. And so I think if people are truly taken, there are all sorts of ways they can reach their goal.
Are there tricks performed by other master magicians that continue to baffle you?
Yeah, it's one of the great pleasures in life. It doesn't happen a lot, but it's wonderful to be fooled.
Where did the tradition of adding Eni to the end magician's name come from?
Well, actually, I can speak to that a bit. It's a vaudeville tradition in the sense of performers finding some... usually Italianate ending that made their name seem more exotic. And, for instance, the greatest juggler at the time of Houdini, I'll get back to him in a minute because he had – it was a special case with Houdini. But this was a man named Cinquevalli, who literally was the most famous juggler in the world, and his real name was Paul Kestner, and he was from Poland, and basically died after World War I because people thought he was German, and they disliked Germans because of the war, and he took to that so personally. But Houdini's case was him specifically admiring the work of Robert Houdin, a 19th-century magician who was considered the father of modern magic, and he thought that that was homage to take Houdin's last name and add an I. But mostly it was just to make names sound more appealing and exotic than a lot of the Eastern European roots that these performers have.
My guest is Ricky Jay. A film called Deceptive Practice, The Mysteries and Mentors of Ricky Jay, opened yesterday at the Film Forum on West Houston Street in downtown Manhattan. David Mamet directed your one-man shows. How did that happen? Was he directing things at the time?
I think over his long career has done a lot of directing, but sporadically. I mean, in any event, we were brought together by Jules Fisher, the famous theatrical lighting designer. He just did the Nora Ephron show, which I saw yesterday. I just thought was absolutely wonderful. Anyway,
Tom Hanks.
Yeah, with Tom Hanks and so many other fine actors, and beautifully directed by George Wolfe. And anyway, Jules had this idea for years of wanting to try to create a permanent variety theater. And the people he wanted to do that with him, I was a longtime friend, and then Mike Nichols and David Mamet. And eventually we did All Me.
Now, do you think that your experience as a performer, as a raconteur, made it easier for you to also do some acting?
Well, that was purely David. I had been in Midsummer Night's Dream in a crazy production. That was my first acting thing. I think it was literally 30 years ago that James Lapine directed for Shakespeare in the Park. But in terms of film and in terms of really thinking about acting seriously, David just said to me, oh, I'd like to write a con movie with you. And then he realized he'd already written one with Jonathan Katz, and he said he'd like me to play a part.
That was Heist?
No, that was House of Games.
Oh, House of Kings. And then there was Heist, there was Homicide.
And Spanish. I guess I've been in 7 or 8 films of his now.
What's the magician's code of secrecy? As a mentor to other magicians, how do you decide what you will and won't divulge?
That's actually a great question. I think in general, yeah, it's true that one is supposed to be the keeper of secrets, and unfortunately that's a code that's violated much more than I think it should be.
There have even been magicians who've shown
the internet.
They've shown how a trick is done, and that's part of their act.
Oh, yeah, there are a few legendarily bad magicians who've done that. But in terms of what you show in the mentoring situation or what your mentors show you, there's this incredible combination of gamesmanship and real tutelage. I talk about it being very much like the student-sensei relationship in the martial arts, and that a good mentor understands how to make you better. For instance, Di Vernon, who I talk about at great length, he and Charlie Miller, I believe, were the greatest sleight-of-hand artists of the 20th century.
And you met them when you moved to Los Angeles.
Well, I actually even met Vernon when I was 4 in New York. We were both living in New York then, although I was too young to really take advantage of his wonderful expertise. But the thing that was interesting about him is many people moved to Los Angeles to study with him. In a piece I wrote years ago, I said he made pilgrims, happy pilgrims of us all. I mean, people just uprooted their lives to be with him. And then he would play them off against each other, which is certainly not a technique I've ever used in showing someone something, but he really would. He knew that there was a certain competition and a certain jealousy, and he enjoyed that. He enjoyed the games of it, but he actually made all of these people better by doing that.
Now, can you tell us about Deceptive Practices, Inc.?
Well, I have a company with Michael Weber. He's my partner in it, and a brilliant, brilliant thinker about magic. And
what kind of services do you supply?
We perform consultations for film, television, and theater, and those can be consultations on the script and If there then is magic in the production, we might see it all the way through, teach the actors and provide the illusions or con material that will be used in the final product.
Have you ever gone into a casino at Las Vegas or Atlantic City or one of the others? I'd imagine they'd be scared to see you arrive.
Well, there have been a few places that have asked me not to play, but I take that as pure flattery. So it's a different world and one that I keep tabs on, but I'm not interested in being a participant in.
Well, it would be great if you could pull out aces.
Well,
a lot of aces during a poker game. Your grandfather, who was an accountant, warned you not to rely on magic to make a living?
Well, of course, but that I suppose makes sense growing up in any New York Jewish family that your family would prefer if you would be a doctor or a lawyer.
But he wanted you to learn how to do it.
Absolutely.
And everybody else in the family.
But he wanted me to go to college and make sure I had the security of a college degree.
Well, you've done okay.
I seem to have, it's been rocky. It hasn't been some straight path.
Really? I've only
money.
Known you as famous.
Ah, well, I mean, I still don't consider myself at that level, but over the last few years, I've had some wonderful things happen.
And people will really enjoy seeing this film. It's called Deceptive Practice, The Mysteries and Mentors of Ricky Jay. It opened yesterday at Film Forum at 209 West Houston Street. That's between Varick and Sixth Avenue. And I thank you so much for being on our show.
My pleasure. Thank you.